the place that I'm at with my work is that actually it's very well received. It's very popular. It's almost the opposite in a way. But I've always got that in my mind that I don't want to be restrained by that. And if there's something I want to say that is unpopular, I don't want to be enslaved by that.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values of the people shaping our common life. You have joined us in a special series themed around my book, Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times. And in each episode of this series, I am speaking to a guest who in part can help me reflect on one of the themes that I have used to structure my chapters, the seven deadly sins. In my chapter on envy, I was really interested in what helps us find a stable sense of self. How do we navigate status anxiety and the tendency, maybe in all societies, but perhaps in especially in ours, to compare ourselves to other people? I really enjoyed speaking to our guest today, Laquena Makava, who is a internationally renowned visual artist. She has exhibited in London, Paris, New York, all over the world, basically, the Tate Modern and the Tate Britain and the Yorkshire Sculpture Park. And she has brought her distinctive visual style to collaborations with brands including Mini, Christie's, H&M, Uniqlo, Fiorucci, I don't know how you say that because I'm not a fashion person, and many other brands. If you are listening to this rather than watching it on our YouTube channel, I'd really encourage you to just go and have a look at Laquena's work. It's beautiful, distinctive, fascinating, and it'll really help you have a framework for our conversation. We spoke about her childhood between Ethiopia and London, her art process, and the way it helps her process hard emotions as a form of meditation, even her thinking around what public artwork in particular can do and how she tries to find a stable sense of self. As usual, there are some reflections from me at the end, and I hope you enjoy listening. Laquena, I'm going to throw this phrase at you, which is not in necessarily kind of common parlance, but I hope will generate some interesting thoughts. What does fully aliveness mean to you?
What does fully aliveness mean to me? I think maybe being present and not kind of caught up with things that are not in the now.
What helps with that? I need more of that.
Yeah, I think I do as well, to be honest. I guess it's just, you know, the busyness of life. Mm. So, yeah, trying to be in the present. Yeah, removing distractions, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I want to get to your values. What are the things that shape your life, the principles you want to live by? I sometimes use this phrase, what are your sacred values? What is sacred to you? What bubbles up with that question?
What are my values? I believe that people are important, that people matter. I believe people are made in the image of God. Mm. I think that's a big thing, actually. It's not always reflected in the way that I treat them, but that is my theory, at least.
Yeah.
Is that I should treat people with love and respect because of that. Yeah, that's a key value.
Where does it show up as a challenge? Can you think of times or places in your life where that value has shaped either how you have decided or you've compromised on it? Like a moment where you think, actually, I can choose to live my values now, or I can choose not to treat you as if you're made in the image of God.
In terms of, I think just like daily, you know, hustle and bustle, bumping past people in the street when it's busy, and sometimes being irritated with people, you know, that kind of thing. I think also judging people, that's something I can be quite judgmental. Yeah. Not necessarily that it comes out, but in terms of in my heart and in my mind, I can be really harsh in my judgment of people. And I guess that, to an extent, that's justified, but then the fingers point right back at me, you know. So,
Yeah, I think that's a challenge we all have, right? There's all this social psychology that we hold other people to much higher standards than we hold ourselves, because with ourselves, we know all the extenuating circumstances, right? Yeah. We know we're tired, or we're on our period, or, you know, we're carrying trauma, or someone's just died. You know, we know all the reasons why we're struggling to make good choices that day, but we don't know any of those reasons with other people.
Yeah.
And so they just look really annoying.
Or we have a bad day and then hold ourselves to that same account and feel like complete failures.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you do that? Are you kind of highly critical of yourself as well?
Yeah, I can be. But I kind of go, there's highs and lows, you know, kind of this and this and this and this.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm like, oh, you know, yeah, I'm doing really well. But, and then being very judgmental of other people who are really annoying me.
Yeah.
And then there's the almost the crash of, oh my gosh, I'm really bad at this and really bad at this and really bad at this. A real awareness of how bad I am. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's almost the two ping pong.
So we're going to talk a little bit about envy and status anxiety and a stable sense of self. And I really want to come to that because I'm so fascinated by this. How do we find a steadiness of soul? How do we find a stable sense of self that is the right level of kind and compassionate with ourselves and the right level of kind and compassionate with other people, right?
Yeah.
And I think that comparison thing comes up a lot in this. But first, I want to hear about your childhood. Would you paint me a picture of maybe your primary school years? What was in the air, maybe religiously or politically or culturally, that was formative for you?
That's interesting. I mean, it's whenever people talk about my childhood, this was kind of a lot of contrast because I was born here in London. Mm-hmm. I moved to Ethiopia when I was six, stayed there for about 2 years, came back here from when I was eight to, well, kind of eight onwards. That was, I guess, probably all fairly consistent.
Can you just say a little bit more? Because I'm not sure there'll be lots of people listening who don't have a really strong mental picture of what your childhood, the bit of your childhood in Ethiopia was like. It's, they might never have visited or they might not really know much about Ethiopia as a country. Could you just sort of say what are the words that come to mind when you think of that bit of your childhood?
So that was a really defining point for me. It was only 2 years, but some of my earliest memories are probably there.
Yeah.
And it was very much, for me, it was a bit of a strange experience, to be honest, because we weren't like, you know, we were living like, I guess, an expat lifestyle, you know, because my dad worked for the UN. We're not Ethiopian. He's Ugandan.
Right.
My mum is English. He was Ugandan. And we were living this kind of very surreal lifestyle. But for me, it was really lovely. It was quite cushy, you know.
Yeah.
It was, we, also for me, what was quite key was that everyone looked like me. You know, I looked pretty much Ethiopian, which was really lovely. Not, I wasn't really aware of that, but I was blended in, felt accepted, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
It was very warm and sunny. There was actually a famine going on at the time, I believe. So it was a very, you know, in reality, a really, really difficult time, obviously, for Ethiopians. I remember a lot of poverty that I'd see in between wherever I was heading to or from. And there was actually, we were evacuated, I think, once or twice. But in the midst of all of that, I was living this very sheltered childhood, which was actually very lovely.
So
it was a really defining time for me, and I think it gave me a sense of Africanness to some extent. You know, a bit of an unusual kind of experience, but it gave me some kind of feeling of rootedness in East Africa. Anyway, so then we got back to England when I was about eight, and there was a big contrast. It felt very grey, just even in terms of the weather. I found that quite difficult. It was very cold, damp, grey, as we know.
Yeah.
It's taken me about 30 years to get used to it, and I love it now, but, you know.
Yeah.
And then also the area where we ended up living in South London was quite, was predominantly white. It was, I was very much a minority. There was, I could feel that I was different from people. And there was some racism, not loads, but I was definitely an outsider. I felt like an outsider very often. So I think that was all very defining for me. Had a big influence on the whole of my life, to be honest.
Yeah, you've talked about this sense of the theme of paradise in your work as and an association, at least for part of your life, with that period, with the sense of something that you're looking for is that colour and that warmth and that life. And then I believe you started making art, sketching and things when you got home. It sounds like it was pretty traumatic, actually, the move. Do you mind to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't use the word trauma a lot because I think in the grand scheme of things, it really wasn't bad.
Yeah.
But I think that I was definitely having to process quite a lot. And I started drawing a lot of pictures of aeroplanes and houses, like little homes with trees and the sunshine, this type of thing. And at the time, I wasn't really aware of it. But looking back, I think if I'd been like in therapy, they'd probably have said, you're
having a hard time with this move.
Yeah. Although I didn't see it as something bad necessarily. I think it was quite a healthy way of coping with it.
Yeah.
Yes, I think for a long time, I didn't feel that this was home. And because actually, even before Ethiopia, my dad had travelled quite a lot with work. You know, we'd lived in Uganda for a while. I think that to me, it was like, yeah, basically, this wasn't home. Like, the plan was to go back to Ethiopia, actually. When we left, we didn't actually know we were never going to go back.
Gosh.
So there was all this kind of thing.
Unfinished business.
Yes, and just the whole of that kind of period of my life, from then on, my dad struggled very often to get jobs, to keep jobs. He was constantly kind of, he was a big dreamer. So he was, and he was very ambitious, but there's quite a lot of kind of, there were a lot of hopes and dreams and kind of the idea of what was going to come, but that never actually came to fruition.
Right.
And we ended up staying here.
Yeah.
And it took me quite a long time to kind of get used to reconfigure my kind of mentality that this was home.
Yeah.
This is where I was going to be. And
Did it feel, am I hearing that it felt a bit precarious financially? That must have been a change from an expat life.
Yes, definitely, yeah. There was, we struggled a lot financially. It was a bit of a weird, it was a weird kind of life because it wasn't your kind of stereotypical struggle. But money was very tight and my mum was very shrewd. So it was very much like she was very organized and very economical. So we survived. But it was all kind of like, everything was very tight and there wasn't much...
Yeah, there was exactly
margin. And my dad was on job seekers allowance, I think, like for the whole of my life. Post that, he had one or two jobs, but yeah, it was like living off benefits, but it didn't really look like that from the outside, which is a weird combination.
Yeah, and tell me more about your mum, because I get the impression she's a big influence on you and was quite unusual in her time.
Yeah, she was. She is.
Yeah, sorry. In her time sounds like...
Yeah.
You know, exactly. A whole other era. While you were growing up.
Yeah, because she's not doing that anymore. But when we were growing up, she's quite a... She's quite eccentric, but not in a conventional way, which I know sounds funny, but you hear eccentric and you kind of think of, oh, she went to art school and she did, you know, she wasn't really like that. She studied languages, which is interesting. That's how she ended up meeting my dad. So she was, and she is, basically someone who does her own thing. And she was somehow, I think because of her upbringing, which was really kind of open. And by open, I mean she didn't have a lot of discipline or any boundaries really in place, because her parents were quite eccentric.
Were they more sort of in the hippie era?
No. So her parents, like her mum was an opera singer.
Right.
And her dad was, he ran a sweet shop, but... It had a bit struggled financially, struggled with business. So they were kind of doing their own thing.
Right.
And anyway, so they were quite old, I think. They had kids later on in life for that generation.
Yeah.
But they didn't have any, I think, they didn't have any kind of strict moral framework. So they didn't basically give her much discipline or many boundaries. So she felt like there were kind of a lot of things kind of mistakes, or not mistakes, but things that she fell into that she could have done with more guidance.
Right.
So she was very aware, particularly of the media.
Right.
And the impact that that could have on particularly young people. I think the generation she was a kid in the 60s.
Yeah.
So in terms of like media, TV, I think she just used to sit in front of the TV and eat.
Right.
That's a lot of what she did.
Yeah.
Before people were kind of conscious of, that you didn't necessarily want to just leave a kid to do that. But so she learned a lot from that, and she was very aware of the impact that the media could have on young people. And just, so she raised us very much to be very aware of that.
Yeah. I loved reading about her work and kind of leading marches, calling for, you know, better regulation of pornographic content and violence. And I have this picture of you as a young girl, like making your own signs. Is that part of your memories?
Yeah, it is. I used to help her make the make banners for her protests. And it was really powerful. Like, it wasn't particularly influential.
Mm.
I mean, she did. She achieved something really great. I think it was something to do with regulation of child pornography or something.
Wow.
Some kind of regulations that were put on by the government. So she went to the House of Parliament and stuff, and she had conferences and things. So they did a lot of great work. So it's not to downplay it, but it wasn't popular.
Yeah. It was quite fringe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It had a massive impact on me because, it taught me that I don't just want to do something that is necessarily popular. Mm. We'd go on these marches and they weren't like super, super well attended, but it was really important. It really mattered.
Yeah.
And I think, it really taught me that. And I hope, I hope that I continue to kind of think like that, because I think nowadays the place that I'm at with my work is that actually it's very well received. Mm. It's very popular. It's almost the opposite in a way.
Yeah.
But I've always got that in my mind that I don't want to be restrained by that.
Yeah, being popular for the sake of it.
Exactly. Yes. And if there's something I want to say that is unpopular, I don't want to be enslaved by that.
Yeah.
So that will always inspire me, what she did. And the fact that it wasn't cool, it wasn't popular, makes it even better to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know Christian faith was part of your childhood, something your parents brought you up in. Did you have a time where you had a crisis, or you rejected it, or a teenage rebellion, or has it been pretty steady in your life?
I didn't actually, but I think my... So as a child, both my parents were definitely like professing Christians. Mm. And we went to church, we'd always go to church, but my understanding of Christianity was very much about right and wrong, and it was very black and white.
Mm.
And I think that's how I understood it. And I was, but it wasn't kind of shaping my, I guess it probably did shape my life, but it was kind of a lot more black and white even than I'm passing on to my children, actually, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think as I got older, I was like, oh, that's just because I was a child.
Mm.
But the way that I talk to my children about God is a lot more, it focuses a lot more on grace, actually, I think, which is interesting.
Mm.
Anyway, I'm grateful that my parents kind of passed this on to me. It's obviously my choice to believe it or not. Although up until I was 16, it was like, well, you're coming to church, whether or not you like it. But I just wanted to because I believed it was the right thing to do. But then when I was about maybe 13, 14, which was around the same time, actually, that I began to find school really difficult socially.
Yeah.
That was a little after, actually. But just before that, I started going to a new church, which was, I think, a lot more focused on the grace of God, actually.
Mm.
and also more open to the Holy Spirit. And I think I met with God for the first time. I think I really met with him. And I remember crying a lot. And it was kind of at that point that I started to think about beyond just black and white and what's right and wrong, but wanting to have a relationship with God and wanting my life to be centered on him. So that happened, I think I was about 13 or 14, and then things got started to get really difficult, socially at school and stuff like that. So I think it was interesting timing. And then I just went deeper into, I used to read the Bible a lot, found a lot of encouragement in the Psalms, just trying to find some kind of anchor, you know?
You've, and forgive me if this is too private, you've spoken a little bit about having kind of melancholic tendencies, actually being a bit of a pessimist. Because honestly, I you maybe get this a lot, but I was sort of surprised to come to that realization about you because your art is so joyful. What do you think is a relationship between that and your kind of temperament?
Yeah, I've thought about that as well. I think it is, for me, it is, my work was definitely, it's something I started to do to speak to myself, you know? So it was, I just realized that my mind can really get tangled up in a knot and I can end up getting dragged down a hole. And I can end up in a really dark place. And, but if I'm focused, you know, it's basically, but what am I meditating on? And I just began to realize it's fairly basic, and most people, with a faith or not, realize that whatever you think about, whatever you meditate on,
whatever you pay attention to,
it's gonna, you're gonna end up getting consumed by that thing. So I just started to realize that, and I started to, I think my work was a way of meditating on good things and on joyful things and hopeful things. Do you see what I mean? So it was basically like an antidote to the fact that, left to my own devices, I will veer to the negative. And there's so much negative stuff to think about, right? So much. It's a chaos. So there's loads of, you know, there's loads of negative things you could dwell on.
I think it made a lot of sense to me into why I mean, and I'm not alone in this, but why I find your art so compelling. Because there's lots of public art, graphic design, sort of public visual culture that gets described as positive and joyful that doesn't move me because it feels a bit trite. That kind of like be positive, good vibes only thing.
No, I don't like it either.
No, it doesn't. It annoys me. It makes me want to go, no, screw you. But there's something about yours which is extraordinarily joyful, which I can, this can make me cry, this is weird, but that I can, something I could sort of tell it's hard fought, but I can tell it's nice. Chosen. There's a gravity about it that's not just like bubblegum.
No, because I'm not into that. And I mean, that I'll see the negative and stuff. But yeah, it's an antidote to it because you just can't live like that. And like there was, I think there were times growing up when I went into that space and I embraced that. And I ended up alone and depressed. So it's just, you know, however real you want to be, it's not fruitful. So, you know, you've got to find a way out of that.
What, at what point did that, you know, you were processing these hard things through your art, you were sounding like just dealing with things in a really healthy way. At what point did you think, I'm going to be an artist? That's who I am.
So funnily enough, I was going to study languages. I think I was. Because I like words. I like language. It was good. I was going to study language and linguistics. But I went to Brazil. I was invited by some friends. And I lived there for about 5 months. And I ended up painting. Again, I was kind of, I was doing some volunteering work. But then the guy who I was living with, he was actually a pastor. He asked me to, I think he, some, I ended up painting a mural, basically. And I realized that when left to my own devices, what did I want to do? I ended up painting. Do you see what I mean? So then I came back to London and I got a place on clearing to study graphics.
Yeah.
And so that's when I decided, because before that, my whole life people had said, oh, you should be an artist because I was good at drawing.
Mm.
But I hadn't wanted to be because someone had drilled into me that you couldn't make money from being an artist, that it wasn't a steady, stable job.
Yeah.
So I had just said, I think I wanted to be an accountant or something because I was also good at maths.
Yeah.
So that was like, you know, I'll do that. And then the languages came about, I don't know, because I was interested in languages. It was academic at least. Yeah. But yeah, so I realized, well, in Brazil, I'd learned Portuguese and I was like, well, if I want to learn languages, then I can just go to a country and learn the language.
Yeah.
But yes, I decided I wanted to study graphics. And for me, that was a, like, that I could see a job out of it.
Yeah.
But it was involved in visual culture.
Yeah.
So that's what I ended up doing.
Yeah, I think there's often a thing, isn't there, about, and they talk about this a lot in sort of arts and culture world, that people who think, I know, I'll do a fine art degree and see what happens, probably have come from an economic background that doesn't feel precarious, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't feel like, I know I need to earn a living from something, so I'm going to take quite a pragmatic decision.
Yeah.
But you have kind of woven your way via, you know, different opportunities into this extraordinarily kind of successful career, doing something that feels like sort of, I'm not sure how helpful these boxes are, but very graphics inflected public art.
Yeah.
Right. And we can see those influences of sign writing, the way, you know, you're using words and then you're playing with words and that sort of very beautiful and compelling public art that you're making. What, for like saying, what is your philosophy of public art? It's a very grandiose way of putting it. But when you do a piece and you think, yeah, that is right in the heart of my vocation, what are the ingredients of that? What are you trying to do?
I guess, well, often I'm asked, it depends, because I do lots of different things, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, you know, I also make paintings in the studio. I do collaborations with brands. So I do lots of different things.
Yeah.
But in terms of the public work, I'm often asked to make work in very grey, concrete spaces. And I think the idea is, it's not that complex. It's basically bringing colour and something, basically, you know, disrupting that very grey, concrete space. That's often what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you are using words, so there's, you know, I was looking at the Still I Rise murals you were doing in the Young Offenders Prison in Arkansas, extraordinarily moving, and, you know, Nothing Can Separate Us, this very famous piece that you made. When a phrase sticks with you, tell me more about that process, because, you know, you could choose different words, you could use no words. What is it about the phrases that you use that draw you?
Yeah, it's funny. So, sometimes they'll be my own words. Mm. Sometimes they'll be from elsewhere. Still I Rise was referencing exactly Maya Angelou, who was from Arkansas.
Nice.
So that was felt like a nice fit. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm very prayerful about the words that I use.
Yeah.
And I think I'm not a poet and I wouldn't claim to be. And I feel like I should read more poetry, actually. Like, you know, there's always room for growth. But I think there's definitely a pragmatism to it.
Mm.
And you said that word earlier. And it's something I've think about more and more recently, especially having kids. Often when I'm talking to people about my work, pragmatism comes up a lot.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there isn't loads of time. There isn't always loads of money. It depends.
Mm.
But I think the reason I'm using it now is because when thinking about the words that I use, there's like, it's something to do with that that balance between hope, but also, like you're saying, not it becoming trite.
Mm.
Like, it needs to be grounded and plain in a way.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, people need to be able to actually get in contact with it somehow.
Yeah, and it needs to feel not too flowery.
Yeah.
And Nothing Can Separate Us was a really funny one. Not funny, but when I was painting that, it's funny because I think before that I hadn't used words quite so... It's just a statement.
Mm.
And it's not particularly romantic.
No.
but it's actually super romantic.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's epic.
Yeah.
But it's very plain. Nothing can separate us. It's almost like you could read that in the instructions for a for putting together a bed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah.
I think that's, I'm always trying to strike that balance. You know, it's also not science. Like, and I'll be in conversation with someone, something will come up. Sometimes it'll be a song that I've been listening to over and over again. But those are the kind of, with the songs, what I really love is that we sit down. Some people listen to the radio all day long.
Yeah.
I don't actually, but you know, I like music. And some people have got their AirPods in the whole time. Mm. And I'm all really interested in that idea. Music is a big part of my family history, I think, like almost culturally. But also, like, I just think, I'm really interested in the power that music has that art doesn't have. Because with music, you know, you just play a song on repeat and you're listening to this. And even in the song, the chorus repeats itself, the verses repeat itself. You could have a song that repeats the word love, love, love over and over again, you know. Yeah. And I just think that's incredible.
Yeah.
And so in a way, with the words that I use, I'm often thinking in that way.
Yeah.
You know,
The
way that music deals with words is kind of what I'm thinking about in a way, I'm playing with.
Yeah, there's an immediacy to it. And I've heard you speak elsewhere about the sort of anti-elitist instinct that a lot of the art world, particularly the fine art world, is sort of almost self-consciously difficult to understand.
Yeah.
Right? And a lot of us feel like quite out of place in a modern art gallery because we feel like we need to have read a lot of gender theory or whatever.
Yeah, and you kind of do
to
actually understand the work. Yeah.
Yeah, the references. And yours is not, it's the opposite of dumbed down, but there is an immediacy and accessibility about it. And I think one of the things we have in common is we're really interested in cultural stories. And, you know, part of this is the legacy of your mum. Like, what are the stories that our culture is telling us, that the media is telling us, that our visual culture is telling us, and how is that shaping us? Mm-hmm. And the word that was coming to mind when I was thinking about your work was cultural liturgy. Which is this phrase from a guy called Jamie Smith, who's a philosopher in the States, and he talks about this church. Liturgy is quite a churchy word, right?
But yes, I've been looking into it recently, though.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Liturgy, just the word liturgy. Yeah.
Maybe it'll pop up in a piece of work. But it, you know, it's this churchy word that means the sort of form of a worship service. But Jamie Smith's understanding of it is liturgy are sort of desire-shaping technologies. They form us, they change us, right? These repeated things, we are choosing to turn our attention to a thing. And as you were saying earlier, when we choose to turn our attention to the thing, we take control of our formation. We are changed by the things we pay attention to. And he uses like that example of football stadium as a cultural liturgy. Shopping mall and social media is like the definition of a cultural liturgy because it's shaping us in a direction that we have not consented to go, but we are just allowing
that's
this
mad,
power
isn't it?
Into our imagination. Yeah. But your work feels like healthy cultural liturgy, just like a statement
that's
in the
really
street
nice. Yeah, yeah.
Of colour
that
and joy.
That is what I'm aspiring to, basically. Because, you know, I think as humans, we are designed we are liturgical beings, right?
Yes, yes.
I think, do you know Jonathan Pajot?
Yes.
So that's he gave this talk on liturgy. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, I was writing down. So he was talking about the idea that we are liturgical beings, and liturgy isn't a word I'm very familiar with or was very familiar with.
Yeah.
Particularly because at different points, churches I've been in haven't been super...
They don't think of themselves as liturgical.
Conservative.
Yeah.
And haven't been, very obviously liturgical.
Yeah.
But I think it's really interesting, and I think we are liturgical. So Jonathan Pajot, the talk that he gave, he was talking about... conventions, are they called conventions? You know, Star Trek conventions and stuff.
Yeah, they are. That's such a funny reference.
The people dress up.
Yeah.
And to participate in these people who are atheists, you know, have no concept of faith or anything like that. And they dress up in these outfits to participate in these stories.
Yeah, it's a collective ritual.
It's crazy. The rest of us kind of think they're weird, you know.
But, for those Star Trek convention attenders listening, we love you.
You're welcome. I have a close family member who's been to a convention, so, you know, I'd quite like to go one day. But, like, I think that's really interesting. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And it tells you that there is something wired into us that somehow yearns for this, longs for it, and enjoys it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I'm really interested in that. And, I definitely, like, with my work, there's a place that used to be a chapel. I think it's now a bank or something. And above it, it says, enter, rest, pray, I think it says.
Wow.
And there's probably a lot of buildings like that. But the reason I mention it is because I've always been interested in that heritage that we have in this country specifically. Because that's where I am. The fact that we've got these buildings dotted around, that we have like the remnants of this, you know?
Yeah.
And I just think I've always been really interested in that because, you know, in terms of being an image maker, that whole world, the whole art world, all of that is very set against any of that. And it's almost like it's in its own, it's got its own canon, I guess you could almost say, like the modern, the modern kind of tradition.
Yeah.
It's not, they wouldn't say it's not a tradition, but it is a tradition, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's completely removed. It appears to be completely removed from all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And in terms of when I was, you know, learning about art history, it was, when I was learning about contemporary culture, it was completely removed from that.
Yeah, very secular.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm looking for. And so that's what I was, you know, taught about, and that's kind of what I was almost conditioned to, that's how I was conditioned to kind of think.
Mm.
But obviously, all of that time, I had my faith, which shapes everything that I see and do.
Yeah.
So, so I think, but when I see these remnants and these little hints of generations of people who came hundreds of years ago, and not that long ago even, you know. Mm. I think because I am invited to make public work, which is on these same roads and streets that were inhabited by these people hundreds of years ago who had this different set of beliefs, I think, part of my kind of vision is to find ways of kind of grabbing onto those little remnants, but almost translating them, and it's not quite the right word, but reappropriating them for a contemporary audience, you know, who need them just as much, you know?
Yeah.
But don't realise it. And
you do it so well. Your work is so contemporary. Like the reason loads of brands want to work with you is there's a vividness and an immediacy to it that makes complete sense to people for whom going into a building that says, you know, enter, rest, pray would make no sense.
Yeah.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about envy and about status anxiety. And my original trigger for going looking for an artist that I wanted to talk to is I have a sense from my artist friends that envy is a sort of particular temptation for lots of them. My book's based around the seven deadly sins, and I think we all have things that we struggle with in terms of disconnection and things that we don't. And the way I try and write about it is the search for a stable sense of self and the way the world tells us to have a comparative sense of self, really. You know, are we better than other people? Are we richer than other people? Are we hotter than other people? Have we got more followers than other people? And how much these status calculations...
Yeah.
I can tell it. Even when I'm inviting someone to a podcast, I'm like, I need to blow up my sense of status in the invite in order for them to take me seriously. I'm like, look at all the cool guests I've had.
Yeah.
Pay me your attention. I can't just come
as a
human.
And there's a degree of that which is... appropriate.
Yeah, yeah. And again, pragmatic.
Because, like, so that they know that you're not going to waste their time.
Exactly. That I'm sort of a serious person, you know, who it's
your
worth
credentials.
Their time. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And it's so baked into life, this signaling of who's worth our time and who isn't. And, you know, you went from being someone who hadn't been in the art world, who came via graphics, had this funny thing happened with Beyonce being photo taken in front of your mural, and are now very successful. How have you tried to navigate status anxiety, envy, a stable sense of self in your life? Just tell me a little bit about that. It's quite vulnerable to talk about, so, you know, do it as vulnerably as you feel comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. So I definitely, you know, agree with all the things you're saying. It's definitely something that I struggle with. So I definitely don't feel like I've mastered it at all. but how I navigate it is it's almost like a daily, it's almost cyclical. Mm. You know, I was talking about the ping pong and that I'll go from one thing to another. So I think it's almost a cyclical thing in terms of it's something that I have victory over and then I find I'm sucked into it again and then I get out of it again. You know, it's something that unfortunately is recurring. And I think how do I navigate it? Trying to focus on my own path, you know, all the stuff anyone will say, really. Trying to focus on my own path. What was it I was thinking about today? Humility is a massive one for me. Just trying to be, you know. And I think rather than seeking to be the best, seeking to be the lowest, which I know is really weird. It's countercultural, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But seeking to be a servant rather than seeking to be the boss.
Yeah.
You know. So those are the types of things that I'll meditate on when I'm trying to get through this, you know. And I think also just practically for me, it's about staying away from stuff like social media as much as I can. Recently, I've started accessing Instagram by my computer so that it's
limit on it.
Much harder to get sucked in.
Yeah.
Because the minute I'm on my phone, even just from funny things.
Yeah.
So that's not about envy, but it's just the distraction of like, and then I'm in.
Yeah. So I'm changing it to the loo with you.
That's what I mean. So I think for me, in terms of envy, just avoiding looking at what everyone else is doing because I don't need to be looking at what they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
And I can just so easily start comparing myself to that. So I think those are some of the ways that I navigate it.
Yeah. How have you found becoming a mother while trying to be an artist? Has that been a thing you've had to navigate in that?
Yeah, it's been really hard. I think something I often say is, one thing that I find hard in terms of envy is being a mother. You know, like right now I'm working a lot less than I would be if I didn't have kids. Because she's now about 15 months, my youngest.
Wow.
So she's not in full-time nursery or anything. So I'm trying to really be there for her.
Yeah.
But it means that my work has to be squished a bit, which is a conscious decision and I'm happy to make that decision.
Yeah.
But it has its sacrifice, which is that I'm not able to give all that I want to my work. And so what's difficult about that is then I can sometimes be envious of people who are giving all they want to
all
their work.
All the time,
But I think another thing, you know, you briefly touched on earlier about you don't know what other people are dealing with. And, you know, sometimes I'm chatting to people and I'm like, you know, fellow artists or all sorts of people. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I have MS.
Yeah.
Or they say, yeah, I've got this eye condition, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, you've got your own bag of limitations. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, I'm healthy. I've got eczema that I struggle with on and off, but you know, I'm really in good health. And I think that sometimes is worth bearing in mind for me is that, yes, I've got these three kids who are taking all of my energy, but there's people have got all different sorts of things that that are holding them back.
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily able to give all they want to their art, or they've got a part-time job because their art alone can't support themselves.
Yeah.
So that's something that also helps me to just be like, and the reality that I've been thinking about a lot recently, which is that the most money and the most time does not equal the best work.
Yes.
So actually the limitations aren't necessarily, they can bring out, you know,
your creativity.
Yeah.
Aquina, it's been such a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time and your grace and your hospitality today on The Sacred.
Thank you.
So, firstly, can I name the thing? that will be very obvious if you have seen any of kind of Laquena's stuff is, and, or her herself, which is that she's just very, very cool. And I was quite intimidated when I first started playing with the idea of interviewing her. And when you're thinking about the theme of envy and status anxiety, I think it's quite helpful to notice those things. Who are the people that we do not... that we feel intimidated by, that we feel a bit sheepish about our own identity and whether we are sort of cool enough or worth their time. And I think it's probably really different for different people who we think of as, frankly, like, let's name it, just like slightly higher status from us on a range of things. And in your tribes, that might be about money or intelligence or there's all manner of ways that we sort of semi-consciously rank ourselves. But as someone who is not hugely visually motivated until quite recently, really didn't, you know, wasn't that, felt very intimidated by fashion. Someone like Laquena just seems too cool to have anything to do with me. And of course, when we start challenging those things in ourselves and we start connecting with people, not as these sort of set of tribal signifiers, but as rigorously particular individual human beings in all their complexity and fragility, all that falls away. And of course, Laquena is not intimidating. She is thoughtful and delightful and complex human, like all of us. You know, very unassuming, very keen to listen. Absolutely lovely, as you will have heard. So just naming that journey that I went on of intimidation to connection and how we can... if we bring that to a bit of consciousness in ourselves, it might really help us. I think actually people who are who intimidate other people for a range of reasons, and I have been told that I also do this, I think partly just because I present as quite tall and confident. The extreme levels of that around people who are very powerful or you know, famous, very rich or whatever it is, I think can end up very lonely because no one knows how to connect with them, and that intimidatingness can create real relational distance. So I would just encourage us all to challenge those things in ourselves and just treat someone like a human being because that's what they are. Oh, you know, and one of the reasons it's Laquena stopped being intimidating, and this is why I so often start with people's childhood, is we heard that, gosh, that tender little eight-year-old coming back from this place where she'd been so happy and felt so free and felt able to blend in, not standing out as a mixed race person, but blending in. And then suddenly in the UK where she did stand out and it was cold and grey and all those things. And if really hearing that sense of rupture, that sense of where is home? Where is my place? You know, where do I belong? And I often hear this with people who've experienced migration or immigration, people for whom their racial identity has been something they've had to navigate, usually because they are a minority somewhere. And I'm interested in how often it's part of the story of artists, not necessarily that path, but things that I often think of artists as people who just stand slightly outside often and see things differently, help us see things differently because they have this slightly kind of set back view of what's going on, not always, but sometimes. I think that combo, that kind of geographical transitions that she went through, combined with her mom, who was constantly asking these questions about, like, what are the stories this culture is telling? How do we be critical about the media that we're consuming and notice how it's trying to shape us and how it's trying to form us? Really, that critical eye on culture, I think, shows up in Laquena's work and in the work of so many artists that are... So it's a gift they give us. It's a way they engage in our common life that we really need, I think. Another thing I wasn't really expecting is how this sense that actually Laquena's temperament is quite melancholic. She's talked a bit about, you know, dealing with depression at points, her natural tendencies being towards the negative and the cynical. And it's such a beautiful thing to see, one, someone being really honest about that in public, and one, seeing how her work is that hard-won joy, you know, is that hard-won beauty, is that resistance actually to the cynicism, resistance to the darkness, a deliberate meditation on a form of attention training, a liturgical attention training on what is joyful and beautiful and true. And her ability to really change the environment with these giant public murals that she does, really change a whole area with just this pop of hope and colour and the kind of ministry that I think her work can be. And then we landed on sense of self and this really difficult thing of coming to consciousness of how much we compare and then trying to find somewhere else to steady our souls, to find a stable sense of self. And it sounds so easy. Don't compare yourself. Don't look at what other people are doing. You know, follow your own path. I don't think L'Aquina was saying it's easy. It's not easy for any of us, but I think particularly around creativity, there is something about, and this is where my kind of rabid, radical communitarian leanings breaks down, because even though I really want us to be thinking more collectively and less as individuals, part of my kind of theological anthropology, my understanding of what human person is also a particularity that each person has, is seen and known for themselves. And there's something about their selfness that the world needs that is a gift to the world. And so I think that sense that often in creativity, it's a clearing away of scripts, a clearing away of assumptions, a clearing away of doing things like everyone else, comparing yourself with everyone else and bringing your own charism, your own gift, your own voice into the world. It's something that I had to really navigate through when I was trying to learn to write as myself, you know, not with the voice of nonfiction books, not with the voice of theological texts, not with the voice of anyone else, but the things that I wanted to say and trying to say it like myself in the hope that that creates more space for others too. I love that really humane ending. You know, one of the antidotes to envy is compassion, is realizing that, yes, everyone else might look like they're doing better and having things easier, but actually, you know, it's just that old sort of adage / cliche, which contains a seed of such truth, which is be kind. Everyone else is fighting a fight that you don't know about. And when we have compassion on each other, it's much harder to feel envious and to feel that disconnection when we withdraw from each other because we're jealous and comparing, and instead just acknowledge that we're all fragile and finding our way. Thank you so much for listening to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield. Our production team are Dan Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Amari Yagandran. The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos, and we would love you to come and check out our wider work. And I really enjoy being in conversation with you. You can find me in lots of places. I have my own website. I'm on Twitter and Instagram, probably too much. And I have a Substack called morefullyalive.substack.com. Until next episode, thank you so much for listening. Oh.